Tonight's Beit Midrash sessions are sponsored, I believe, by the Italis. Let me just bring it up for a second. Thank you to the Italis for sponsoring today's sessions. Here it is. Thank you to the to Ami and Irene for sponsoring in loving memory of her mother, Shendel Bas Yisrael Halevi. Hopefully our learning and everyone else's learning from the other classes will be Le'ilei Nishmasa for the elevation of her soul. Okay, we are in Perek Zion. Give me a second here. I'm going to put it up on the screen. Hold on. I'm going to make sure no one... Okay. If anyone wants, as Stephen said, you could find it on Safaria. You can probably just look up Mishlei 7 and it'll pop up at some point. But I'm going to share it on the screen here. Website URL 238023. Okay. It'll pop up shortly. We were in the middle last week of talking about a theme that we had talked about before, which is the seductive woman. And the seductive woman, as we know, represents more than just literal woman, but also represents our inclinations in general. So when we look at these psukim, remember that we're coming on the heels of a very interesting statement that she had made, according to Shlomo HaMelech in his analogy of this situation, that she had just said to him, I have... Zivchei Shlamim, right? To quote the pasuk explicitly, so she says, according to Shlomo HaMelech, Zivchei Shlamim alai, I have the meat of a Shlamim offering. Hayom Shilamti Nidarai, I just basically cashed in on my vows. So she's got a lot of meat. So what's the purpose of that? The reason that that's important is because the very first pasuk that we have here is the word Al Kain. Therefore. And if the word Al-Kain is therefore, so we have to understand what came beforehand. So presumably what came beforehand is this mitzvah of eating from the karbanos. So she therefore came to this guy. Why is that important? If you look at the first source here, or the second source here, this is from the Vilna Gaon. The Gra says, Al-Kain yatzasi, therefore I have come out. If you look at the end of the pasuk, it says, L'shacher panacha, to seek out your face. And I found you. So says the Gra, what does that mean? Kevan sheish mitzvah tachas yadi, because I've got a mitzvah to do, and v'ani yodea sha'ata ohev mitzvos, and I know, you're a guy that loves to do mitzvos. V'ani ohev chameod, and I love you so much, al ken yatzasi, I care about you so much, al ken yatzasi levake shoscha, I came to find you, sheta seha mitzvah, so that you can do the mitzvah. Look, I know how much you like doing mitzvos, so I wanted to come and offer you the opportunity to eat from these karbanos, which is part of the mitzvah. And just happens to be that I found you right away, because clearly it was min hashamayim, right? In the words of Shlomo HaMelech here, min hashamayim siyu Hashem tzaecha tekef. It was hashkacha pratis that we found each other right now, right? Basically, as Shlomo HaMelech is depicting it, this woman is trying to make the claim to this man, or as you saw last week, this young adult, that he should not be afraid, but rather excited, because she has a mitzvah for him to do. She has a lot of meat inside that he can take part in, the mitzvah of the shlamim that she brought. So that's how the Gra explains it, and you can see from the Al-Sheikh, the next source, Rav Peninim, V'al-Kain Yatzasi Baal Yivazer Mehem, She'im Lo-Kain, Eineni Yatzanis. If it wasn't for the karbanos, for the meat that I have to eat, I wouldn't have gone out. V'gam lo zulascha. And also similarly, I wouldn't have gone out if it wasn't for you, Mr. Mitzvos guy. Ki eineni me'elu ha'ochos achar kol ilver. I'm not one of those people that goes and chases after everybody that walks by. Ki rak oscha yadati. I know about you. L'masha gam ata elai ish kilavi. You and I are like the same. Vizel, that we both like doing mitzvos. Vizel likraseich. Ki gam ata ba ha'isa yilai v'em ta'eka klomar mitzasich kasher im levavi. I found you just because you know, it just happens to be that we're both interested in the same stuff. And you shouldn't think that I'm, God forbid, a harlot. And it's not because I want to just, you know, fulfill my desires that I found your face, that I sought out your face. It's because of this I went out to find you. Just come, help me do this mitzvah for a second, and then that's the only reason I came out here to seek you out. So a theme that we've seen before, but maybe we can talk about it in a little bit different terms. And as we started with tonight, this woman is not simply a woman which represents the desire of a woman, but also the desires of all things. A person is enticed to do one thing or another. And there are all different types of arguments that a person makes within themselves, right? Sometimes we call this the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. So one of these evil inclinations is not simply, you know, do this because you really want to, but do this because it's a good thing to do. And this is exactly that argument. This woman is coming to say, this is not just for the sake of desire. This is for the sake of a mitzvah. This is an important aspect. This is an important pursuit that we should get engaged in this, doing this mitzvah. And this is oftentimes the argument that the Yetzer Hara tries to pull on us, that it's not just, you know, filling your desire. Don't think of it like that. No, this is for some good purpose, some important purpose. And this shift, I think, is a very interesting shift, because what it is, what it represents, as we've been saying, is not that the argument is that a person, you know, has desires and has needs and therefore has to satisfy those needs, but rather that what you're doing is actually, you know, what God wants you to do. It's what morality would tell you to do. And the reason that people have this internal thought process, the reason that people feel the need for that mental justification, is something called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance, which has, I think, seeped its way into a colloquialism nowadays. But what it means basically is that a person has two presumably competitive thought processes. On the one hand, they think that X is okay. And on the other hand, they think, wow, I really want to do Y. But these things, X and Y, they don't jive together. They don't work together. So something's got to give. Either you're going to have to tell me that Y is no good, or you're going to have to explain why X is no good. Or a third option is that you make X and Y the same, right? And this can apply in a whole slew of situations. But each situation it deals with it in its own way. But in some ways, we deal with this religiously also. You know, and unfortunately, for some people, and this is a little bit off track, but I think it's important to talk about, for some people, the concept of modern orthodoxy is very, creates a lot of cognitive dissonance, right? Because on the one hand, we think of shul as this holy, separatist, you know, insulated spiritual endeavor that you have to be inside of a bubble to really feel holy and spiritual. The second you go outside, so then that's sort of like not shul. It's not the Beis Medrash. It's not, you know, the signs aren't in Hebrew. And the rabbi is not your boss, right? You have a whole slew of different considerations which seem to be at odds with what you consider to be spiritual or holy pursuits. And I think a lot of people struggle with this. And on this very serious note, a lot of people struggle with this cognitive dissonance where they feel like Judaism or holiness is particularly or exclusively pursued in the context of an insular bubble or some kind of, you know, externally holy place like a shul or a Beis Medrash. And you can see this in a lot of different avenues, to the left and to the right. Because some people will say, well, I can't be in the real world, I can't be in the outside world, unless I give something up. Right? On the one hand, I either have to say, Judaism is no good for me, and then I'll just completely engage in the outside world and in secular values. And some people will say, well, I have to give up the secular world so I can stay in the Jewish world. The two things don't seamlessly work together. You have to really work at it. And obviously, we believe that that God put us on this earth in order to embrace the world that he put us in and make it holy, even in its seemingly unholy state. But for a lot of people, that's difficult to do. It's a lot easier to just stay inside. It's a lot easier to stay inside, but at the same time, that's not necessarily the best plan. Oftentimes, the right thing to do is the most difficult thing to do. And that's why, you know, in modern Orthodox, we always have to be very careful about making sure we're very clear on the fact that our engagement with the world is not at the same time a betrayal of the shul or a betrayal of Orthodoxy, but rather the two things are going hand in hand and we embrace them together. But I think that cognitive dissonance is apparent in many people. Whether you know someone who, you know, went off the derech or you know someone who flipped out. In many ways, what's going on psychologically, internally for a person is that cognitive dissonance, where they feel the need to choose one over the other. And in the same way, in very difficult circumstances, like this person's desires, that's presumably what's going on here. It's not good enough to say that I have a desire and I have to fill the desire. But in order for me to justify the desire, that desire has to somehow be an actual mitzvah. I have to make it into something which is actually good. Not just that I can succumb to something bad. And that's why you see here the metaphor that Shlomo HaMelech is using, the Zivchei Shlamim, specifically Zivchei Shlamim, Al Kein Nisazir Gazev, the only reason I'm getting together with you, says the evil inclination, is because we've got something, a mitzvah to do. This is somehow a good thing for you. You can see a little bit of a interesting... Just a little summary or a little overview of this kind of idea in the fourth source here. Don't make me try to pronounce this person's name, but Mistakes Were Made, which is actually the title of a book I want to read, but I haven't gotten to it yet. Article on Medium.com. So the article says, people tend to justify their mistakes. Cognitive dissonance is the term used to describe the uneasiness people feel when they have two conflicting ideas or views. After making a mistake, people tend to justify their decisions which led to the mistake, even if they know they did the wrong thing. People try to avoid or diminish the feeling of having done something wrong and try to justify their decisions instead of admitting their error. Justifications are made through confirmation bias. The confirmation bias is the tendency of people to look at information which supports their current belief or conviction. Doing so can make them find information that supports their case even if there is no evidence, or worse, it can make contradictory evidence look like supporting evidence, and that's exactly what we're talking about here. But self-justification and the confirmation bias tend to start after a series of decisions. This process is known as the pyramid of choice. So this is very interesting because what the article is saying is not only can you flip one thing to mean its exact opposite, but oftentimes it only comes, this tendency only comes once you've already made a couple of decisions in that direction. And you're trying to retroactively justify what you've already done, but also continue doing what you seem to want to still do. And that's particularly interesting in our case, because as we know, tonight we're jumping into the middle of the analogy. The analogy already started last week, and in line with this article, so we know that Shlomo HaMelech said that what did this person do? They were walking in the marketplace, and then they got a little closer to the corner, and then they got even closer to the house, and slowly but surely they ended up right in front of the girl's house, right in front of the woman's house, meaning that this person had already made bad decisions. They already took specific steps to get to that point. And it was after that point that he's now, sort of the evil inclination is now saying, it's a mitzvah, meaning it's also not only justifying an act that the person wants to do in the future, but it's retroactively justifying the things he's already done. And that, I think, is also a very important point, that oftentimes we have a difficulty to admit what we've already done. And one of my, you know, as you know, I like to quote a lot of self-help books, psychology books, whatever. And perhaps the book that really started me on this kick was a couple of years ago, a book that I heard another rabbi quote, or a friend of mine quote another rabbi, which was Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz. People might know Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz. He was here at the Young Israel a few months ago to speak as a scholar in residence. And a friend of mine once told me about a drasha he gave where he used a specific book called Give and Take. It's a book by Adam Grant, actually a graduate of Michigan, University of Michigan, go blue, and at least the business school. And in there he talks about what he calls the ego threat. And I'll just read you a little bit of it. Let me see here, I'm on the wrong page, so that's not going to work. So he says that, where's a good place to start here? Page 113 in Give and Take. He says, gamblers in the hole believe they'll just play one more hand of poker. They'll be able to recover their losses or even win big. Struggling entrepreneurs think that if they get their, if they just give their startups a little more sweat, they can turn it around. When an investment pays off, meaning something that you've already done, doesn't pay off, even if the expected value is negative, we start to invest more, right? Because we've already done something, we don't want to get out of it. So some people think that this behavior is called, economists explain this behavior using a concept known as sunk cost fallacy. I don't know if anyone's ever gambled or played cards or something like that. Sometimes, I don't know if anyone is familiar with poker. Sometimes you're dealing with another a very aggressive player. I've never played poker for money, so I don't want that to get me in any trouble. But sometimes you're playing with somebody and they're very aggressive, right? And they're betting very early in the hand. For people who don't know what poker means, so then this is not going to make much sense. But they bet very early in the hand before you know what cards you're going to be dealing with. And you feel like you're pressured to put chips in the pot so that you can win the pot. And then you get your cards and they're not so good. And you can't really justify putting as much money as you already done. But you say to yourself, well, I've already put in that much. I've already put in so much money, I might as well keep going. Right? And that's called the sunk cost fallacy. When estimating the value of a future investment, we have trouble ignoring what we've already invested in the past. Same thing's going on with this person who has this desire in front of him. He's looking at what he's already done. He's already gotten to the doorstep of this woman. Sunk costs are part of the story, but new research shows that other factors matter more, right? So Adam Grant is saying that's one aspect of it, but there's another part to it. To figure out why and when the escalation and when escalation of commitment happens, research is at Michigan State University. Go Green. Is that green? Michigan State? It's green, right? Go Green analyzed 166 different studies. Sunk costs do have a small effect. Decision makers are biased in favor of their previous investments, but three other factors are more powerful. One is anticipated regret. Will I be sorry that I didn't give this another chance? I mean, you keep going, right? To go back to the poker analogy, if I keep going, if I fold now, what if, you know, the flop is going to really help me? And if I would have just stayed in, it would have paid off big time. Right? So here you're saying, well, so that's going to motivate you to not want to feel that. You'll be motivated to stay in. The second is project completion. If I keep investing, I can finish the project, right? I don't want to fail in the middle of it. I want to finish what I started. But the single most powerful factor is ego threat. If I don't keep investing, I'll look and feel like a fool. In response to ego threat, people invest more, hoping to turn their project into a success so they can prove to others and to themselves that they were right all along. Really important concept here. And it really just means that you're afraid to look yourself in the mirror if you fail. Right? We're afraid of failure, not because other people are going to see it, not because it's going to be broadcast to other people, but we can't deal with ourselves if we keep failing. We have to succeed at some point to make ourselves feel good about what we're doing in life. And the same thing is true here. When with this person is at this doorstep of the woman, so he's gone around the corner already. He's already been, you know, seduced to an extent. Now he's standing at the doorstep and he's thinking to himself, oh my gosh, what am I doing? Have I made the wrong decisions? Have I made a bunch of wrong decisions? And he says to himself, well, let's hear what she has to say. And she says, Zivche shlamim elai, I have the mitzvah of eating the meat of the karbanos. So he says, yeah, the mitzvah, yeah, that's good, that's a good one, yeah. And he's thinking in his head that all these things that I was just, you know, second guessing, that all these little steps I was making that internally I really feel like it's the wrong decision. Here, I'm still making arguments to myself so that not only can I justify continuing, but I can also justify what I've already done. And that's, on the one hand, the sunk cost fallacy, but more importantly, it's an ego threat. Because the person feels guilty, and in order to cover that guilt up, in order to make sure that they don't feel so bad about themselves, they want to continue so that they can justify everything they've already done. If you look back up at the top of the page here, so the psukim continue, and again, this is the woman, i.e., the evil inclination, speaking inside of this person's head. Marvadim ravadati arsi. Anyone recognize the word marvadim? Anyone know the word marvadim from something else? No, anyone? Any takers? Marvadim? Marvadim, very unique word. Does not come up very often. How about if I sing it? Marvadim asisalam sheish viarga manavusham. Right? Marvadim. Marvadim are types of beds. Marvadim ravadati rc. Or it means, actually, I'm not sure what the literal translation of the word marvadim means. But I think it means that she decorated the bed. Let me see this for a second.
Is that the same word as ravid hazav?
Yes, it is the same word, or they're related. So here it says, I have perfumed my bed with myrrh. Marvadim kashatati mitasi pikshot haraoi. I think marvadim means bed. Or decorative clothing, maybe.
Eris is a bed.
Eris with a sin is a bed? Yeah, that's probably true based on the words. Marvadim ravadati arsi. Rashi here says, Big de chofesh benoi.
I murdered my bed with myrrh.
Yeah, so in Eish HaSchayil doesn't mean that you made her beds. What does it mean in Eish HaSchayil? You give her, like, beautiful things?
I thought it was, Ravid was like a bracelet.
It could be like the same sort of decoration thing. But let me see how it translates it in the article for Eish HaSchayil. Marvadim. Luxurious bedspreads. Okay, so I guess I don't know. It's about making a beautiful bed for a woman. So here it's basically saying that I've also spread out the bed sheets for you, right? It says Marvadim Ravadati RC. I guess RC could be a type of bed, but Marvadim are specifically for beds. I have decked my couch with covers of dyed Egyptian linen. That's how it says here on the Safari. Chatuvos Etun Mitzrayim. Even nowadays we have the concept of Egyptian cotton, right? I don't know if it's the same thing, but sort of a phrase that's endured the test of time here. Nafti mishkavi mor ahalim mekinamon. I sprinkled my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Oh, I was probably reading the wrong English translation before. Either way, so she's saying, I've got everything ready in the house, which is very interesting because she just got done saying, according to these other mefarshim, she just got done saying that she's going to inside to eat. Right, so now she's already transitioning into the other thing. When I read this, by the way, I had my own generalized take on this, that the first part was for his sake, and the second part was for her sake. Meaning the first part was, I got all this meat for you, you should want to come inside, and regardless of what you want, I did all this work inside it. I made the bed, I sprayed perfume, I did all this stuff, so at least come inside for me. That's how I read this two-pronged persuasion of hers. So anyway, she says in Yudzayin that I put out all these spices and sprinkled my bed with all these good-smelling things. And then she says, Lecha nirveh dodim ad haboker. Let us drink our fill of love until the morning. Nit'alsa ba'ahavim. Let us delight in amorous embrace. I don't exactly know what that means, but the article translates it as, let us rejoice with acts of love, right? Ahavim, like loving things, right? So basically she says, let's you know, enjoy the moment for the night until the morning. So what does it mean, until the morning? So I want to hold off on the words until the morning, and we're going to read the next couple of psukim because it's all going to come together soon. Why, she says, should you not be afraid that something bad is going to happen? And this has to do with some stuff that we talked about last week, but we'll just say it in a vacuum independently tonight. Ki ein ha'ish beveso, because the man, who's the man? It's her husband. My husband's not home. Halach bederech merachok. He has gone far away on the path. And how do I know that he's not coming back anytime soon? Tzror hakesef lakach biyado. He has the purse. He brought his money purse with him. What does it say here? He took a bag of money. Liyom hakese yavo beso. And on a specific time, he's going to come in the middle of the month. Does anyone know why it says specifically the middle of the month there? What's the middle of the month? The middle of the month, I believe, is a reference to the word kese.
Yom kese.
Right, what's Yom Kese?
Kese Yom Chageinu.
Which is a reference to?
The moon is hidden, right?
Yes. So I don't know why it says...
The beginning of the month.
Yeah, that's usually the beginning of the month. I don't know why it says the mid-month, but it's clearly understanding the word kese in a different way than some of the mefarshim. Because if you look at Rashi, so Rashi tells us, well, it's not on the sheet, but I'll just tell you Rashi. L'zman ha-moed ha-kavua v'chin ba-kese li-yom chaginu, ba-kese li-yom chaginu, meaning Rosh Hashanah. Kese meaning covered, that the moon is covered at the beginning of the month. But some go a step further in understanding this as a reference to Rosh Hashanah, but we'll get to that soon. First, let's look at the Mesudas David. The Mesudas David explains that with this concept, ki ein ha'ish al tefachem yibali ki einenu beveso, because the man's not here, ki halach bederech rachok. So this is obviously somewhat of an obvious point to us, but the point is, in some ways, that this distance of the person makes us feel secure. And it's obviously a false sense of security, especially in this case, because it doesn't matter if a human being can't see you, because obviously you have a morality that you have to keep to regardless of who's watching you. But we've talked about this before. There's an interesting study, a series of studies that I found here. This is talking about a bunch of athletes and people in power who think they can get away with things. So a series of studies by Cameron Anderson and Adam Galinsky showed that when male and female participants felt powerful, meaning they felt a certain sense of security, they preferred riskier business plans with bigger potential rewards to more conservative plans, divulged more information and were more trusting during negotiations, chose to hit more often during the game of blackjack. This was true whether the participants had a general higher sense of power, like sports stars and politicians, or were momentarily made to feel powerful in the experiment. Meaning, it doesn't matter if you have this long career of power, even in the moment, if there's something that makes you feel secure, you have an internal compass that makes you think to yourself that you can take more risks. These researchers also found that when in power, people focus more on the potential payoffs of the risk behavior, and much less, if at all, on the possible dangers. This leads to being overly optimistic, even about things no one could possibly control, like avoiding turbulence on an airplane, encountering a dangerous snake while on vacation. Right? So basically, when this woman or evil incarnation is saying, "Don't worry, the guy's far away," what it means is, "Don't worry, you have a certain position of power, you have a certain position of security. These things aren't going to affect you, and therefore, this person is going to be more willing to make the jump." But as I said before, there are those who take the word kese to be more literal. So if you see the Ralbag says the following. Ein ba'ali bebesi. My husband's not home. V'im tomer. And if you're going to say hu karov, maybe you're going to say just because he's not home is not a big deal. He could be around the corner. V'yavohena, and he's going to come here. Halach b'derech mirachok. No, that's what the pasuk says. That the husband, he went far away. V'im tomar ulayavol ayla midarko. Maybe he's going to come home sometime tonight. Teda b'emes ki lakach tzor kasev liknos choros rabos. He went to pay a lot of money to buy a lot of things. Lo yavo lebeso ad yom hakesa. Rotz lomar b'rosh hashana. He's not coming back until kesa, until Rosh Hashanah itself. Perish. Who nikra kesa kamro tikka b'chor shofar b'kesa v'ulam nikra kain. Maybe it's saying specifically this. Ki az Hashem yisbarach al das masha yoshev al kesa lishbo tevel b'tzedek. Meaning that maybe this is literally referring to a person's internal discussions. That the evil inclination is saying, we've got until Rosh Hashanah to do whatever we want. Now, most people don't think this way, at least from the outset of their activities. But some people feel this way when Rosh Hashanah comes along. How many of us have thoughts of doing things better, and then we push them off, and then we say, oh, we're going to get to it. Next week I'm going to learn more. Or next week I'm going to do that davening thing I thought I was going to do more. I was going to, you know, spend a little extra time doing Pesukei Zimra instead of rushing through it. I'm going to get to shul a little early. And such things, this thing happens, and that thing happens, and sooner enough, it's already Rosh Hashanah. And you come to Hashem and you say, I know this entire year I've said I was going to do better for this, that, or the other thing. And look, it's Rosh Hashanah, and now I have to own up to the fact that I didn't do what I thought I was going to do. I kept pushing it off. In this case, it's not just post facto, it's not just on Rosh Hashanah this person is thinking such a thing, but this person is basically saying, well, I don't usually follow my advice until Rosh Hashanah anyway. I don't really think about this seriously until it comes to the time that I have to do tshuva anyway. So why don't I just do it now? I just do what I'm not supposed to do now, and then I'll make up for it in Rosh Hashanah again like I always do. And while I would love to continue, belaboring the point of the difficulty to succumb to your desires, I thought maybe we could take a little bit of a tangent through this Ralbag and talk about something a little more positive. Not necessarily in terms of sin, but something in terms of getting things done and productivity. So if you look here, this is from a woman, Gretchen Rubin. I think I mentioned last week that I stopped reading her book, which is still true. But one of the things that I did remember from her book is something she calls the 1 minute rule. This is from her blog. Much of her book is actually on her blog at gretchenrubin.com. So she says the following. It's very simple. This is her rule. I must do any task that can be finished in 1 minute. Hang up my coat, read a letter and toss it, fill in a form, answer an email, note down a citation, pick up my phone messages, file a paper, put a dish in the dishwasher, replenish the diaper supply by the changing table, put the magazines away, and so on. Anything, and she explains a little more in depth in her book, anything that pops into her mind that she should do, and that thing takes less than 60 seconds to do it, she does it right away. That's her rule. And it's a very interesting concept for multiple things, for multiple reasons. She doesn't explicitly say this here or even in her book, but I'm gonna expand on it as we go here. Yeah, this next paragraph is what I'm gonna expand on. Because these tasks are so quick, it isn't too hard to make oneself follow the rule, but it has big results. Keeping all those small nagging tasks under control makes me more serene and less overwhelmed. It's a very interesting phrase, less overwhelmed. How can you feel less overwhelmed by doing such small little things? And the truth is, and this, you know, I don't have a book to quote until I write this in my own book, but while tasks are different sizes, there are some things that are big and they're going to take a long time. There's some things that are small and they'll take very short time. On a psychological or anxiety level, they take up much similar amounts of anxiety. Right? I don't know if people feel this themselves, but if I have like a drasha to prepare or an email to write, the drasha is going to take me a couple hours at least. But the email is going to take me 2 minutes. Both of them sort of nag at me in similar ways, though. They both sort of, in my mind, say, oh, I've got to do this, and I've got to do this. But really, they're not the same amount of effort. They don't require the same amount of energy. And yet, they both nag at you the same way. So what Gretchen Rubin is saying here, I think what she's saying here is, just doing those small tasks can open up so much anxiety that it releases so much of that nagging feeling. And it's just a small little thing. But because you get rid of it, it doesn't clutter your mind. Oh, I have to do this, I have to do that, and I have to do that. And it feels like I have to do so many things. But a lot of those things are very small. And you just get, they pile up. And therefore, they start nagging at you. And they create a sort of built-up anxiety, which is very easy to take care of. The problem is that we build them up and say, oh, that's only a little thing, I'll do that later. But sooner or later, those little things add up to create a lot of real emotional anxiety within us. And her point is that if you just get rid of those little things very quickly, you'll notice that you're much less overwhelmed. Not because you have so much more free time, but emotionally, you'll feel like you're more free. And that's what I think also is embedded within this concept of the Ralbag, that a person might say, oh, I'll get to it later. You know, I'll get to it Rosh Hashanah time, I'll get to it. Now, that's obviously in terms of sinning and in terms of making sure you're doing tshuva and things like that. But it's the truth. It's true in anything in our functional lives as well, to make sure that we keep our to-do list uncluttered as best as possible by simply doing the quick things. And I'm not always good at that either, but I found that when I'm good at it, it does really make a big difference to do the little things. So definitely sweat the small things. But if you do them quicker, you're not going to sweat them. That's the whole point. But very, very important rule that I found is very, very efficient. It helps you a lot. Emotionally, it helps you. When people ask me for happiness rules or tips, this is where I always get a little off with the book, because I don't live my life dictated by making myself happy. But this is how she's framing everything. When people ask me for happiness rules or tips, I often suggest the 1 minute rule because it's very easy to implement. Several people have made a point of telling me how helpful they found it. One friend told me that her apartment went from being a wreck to being quite tidy without much effort on her part. Another friend said that this productivity had shot up because he had so many little things got done so quickly, he had much more time for bigger tasks. So that was that's actually in terms of time. And we had seen this a few weeks ago by the Making Your Bed from the Navy SEAL, I think it was.
General, yeah.
That Making Your Bed, which is a small thing. And I think, Michael, did you get the book in the end?
I got the electronic book, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I haven't started reading it. It's on my. I haven't read it yet, though.
Okay.
I read the synopsis, but I do a similar thing. There's a book called Getting Things Done, and the idea is do it in two. If it's 2 minutes or less, do it.
Ooh, but 2 minutes or less.
And that is like keep a list of distractions.
Yeah.
So I'm working on something for 30 minutes.
Right.
And I have to focus on my work, and I get an interruption in my head. I thought of something I want to do. I put on my distraction list.
Yeah, no, it's good.
No matter how long it takes, I put it away again. I don't think about it.
Right.
I get it out of my head.
And because...
I don't worry about it, try to remember it. That's the main thing. If we have to remember these things, it takes up brain power.
Yeah.
It takes focus.
And right.
Just get it out. You do it later. I do it at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, and when you know, it's a great idea, and I've done it myself too. When you know what's written down, you don't feel like you have to keep thinking about it. Right? You can just say like...
I get them done. This is like 3/4 of them are done from today.
Yeah.
I just don't do them right then.
And I'll tell you, and you know, this might sound scandalous to some people, but I walk around with little empty business cards in my phone or in my wallet, and I use these to actually write things down so I don't have to think about them. It's not all the time, but the scandalous part is that sometimes I'll do it during davening. And it might look strange, but actually the poskim talk about, or the mefarshim talk about, that if you have a distraction in the middle of your Shemona Esrei, you should pause, think about it, and get it out of your mind, and then continue Shemona Esrei. So for me, it doesn't really happen too much during Shemona Esrei, hopefully, but if it happens like during Pesukei Zimra, when you're not supposed to be distracted either, so just I take out a pen, and I write down on the piece of paper, or right now, you know, where I'm davening, I have a whiteboard right next to me. So I write it down on the whiteboard, and then I don't have to think about it anymore, just like Michael is saying. And it really does help in terms of getting you to focus and getting you to be more efficient when you basically get it out of your mind. So in this situation, it's not necessarily just reminding yourself you're going to have to do it later, but if it's a 1 minute thing, just do it. And then you won't have to, constantly be remembering and thinking about it afterwards. So that's one very important lesson from Gretchen Rubin about not pushing things off until Rosh Hashanah, right? Until the time where you have to do it. Speaking of things that they're going to make you have to do it, so the last three psukim of this sort of analogy, which I want to get, I want to finish with so that we don't have to talk about seductive women again next time. So the pasuk tells us in Chaf Aleph, Hitatu Barov Lakha, Bechelek Svaseha Tadichenu, she sways him with her eloquence, turns him aside with her smooth talk. So first of all, the Mitzudas David says, a very interesting line here, Hitaso Amar Shlomo Hein Ra'isi Shehi Hitaso Oso Achar Da'ata Berov Hergel Divareha, with all of her accustomed speech. So there are a couple of interesting things there. Ashehi Limuda Liftos B'nei Adam U'Bechalkas Ma'amar Svaseha Heidicha Oso Midar Chayasher. That... two things to it, I think. Barov lekha is a very interesting word. According to the Nesudas David, it sounds like she's using her script, right? This is the stuff she's learned how to say. She's learned how to say, and she's become accustomed to using the same kind of phrases and the same kind of arguments to get to lure people in. And that's definitely part of it. But the word that I like focusing on here is the word rove. And this is something I found more and more. The more you talk to... Well, I'm not gonna classify people, but the word rove here means a lot. What does it mean a lot? Barov lekha. So it could mean with the few things that you said, but I found that, and I couldn't find a source for this, but it's definitely true. Some people, when they try to persuade someone or try to make an argument, so oftentimes one of the tactics that they'll use is saying a lot of reasons. Saying a lot of things, right? They'll give you a whole list of things. You can't just say one good reason. They have to say a lot of things, and they almost force themselves to say it. It's this, and it's that, and it's the other thing. And oftentimes, there's really only one good reason, but a person feels compelled. There have to be a lot of reasons. And the truth is, when someone lists a lot of things, similar to what we just said, that you have so many things you have to consider, that, oh, they're probably just right. That's probably true. Because she's saying so many things, or he's saying so many things, making so many arguments, how could I possibly refute all of them, right? And this is a tactic I think some people use, and oftentimes people say nonsensical things when they're trying to give lists. And I've noticed this recently in a few examples that, you know, people who say like this and that and other things like that, when really there's nothing else, right? It's just other things, that and other stuff. Or etc., right? People like to just throw in etc. after a long list of things as if there's more stuff, but it really just means I can't think of anything else. So they just say etc., right? So that's what I think of when I see this word berov. Hitaso berov lekha. She makes it seem like there are so many reasons that this is fine, right? As we saw in her words, oh, it's for a mitzvah, and the guy's out of town, and look how beautiful the bed is, and look how nice it smells. Like, she's giving all these different reasons to try to convince him. That's berov. It's that specifically through the quantity of how much she said that a person is seduced in that way. Okay, next to Chaf Beis, Holech Acharecha Pitom. He goes suddenly, right? Suddenly is a very, very specific word, because what it means here, they translate it as thoughtlessly. Suddenly is a word which connotes a lack of thought, right? It's a lack of planning, a lack of deliberation. And I always think about this, Shavuos time, Kisisa time, that if you think about Mamar Har Sinai, right, the contrast between what was supposed to happen and what did happen. How many days were the Jewish people supposed to wait for Moshe Rabbeinu? 40 days and 40 nights. How many days did it take them to make the Ekel Azav? If it was up to them, it would take an hour. It was Aaron HaKohen that was able to delay them to the next morning, right? Because things that are important and things that are meaningful take time. and things that oftentimes are not meaningful and aren't correct are done very spur of the moment, very quickly. Now, are there things that are important that are done quickly? Of course. But oftentimes when we're doing things very quickly, they can be indicative of a certain lack of forethought, a certain lack of deliberation. And here what it's saying, it happened right away. He didn't think too much about it. Sometimes he doesn't think about it because he doesn't want to think about it. He doesn't want to think about the ramifications of his actions. He doesn't want to think about all the terrible things that he's about to do. He'd rather just go and do it and fulfill that desire that he's having. Kishor al tavach yavo. More interestingly, though, the imagery of Shlomo Melech here is very interesting. Kishor al tavach yavo, an ox that's going to slaughter. Right? I know everyone has ever seen animals in a slaughterhouse, but they walk pretty steadfast despite where they're going. They don't know where they're going. Uch eches al musar avil. And they go like a fool to the stocks for punishment. How's the Archbishop say that? They're rushing like a venomous snake. Eches is like a snake. To discipline the foolish one. Ad yifalach chetz kvedo. When is it ever going to stop? When is it ever going to end? Until the arrow pierces his liver. Until mamish, he's stabbed. Until he actually hurts. And it's painful, right? Kemaher tzipor el pach, like a bird who's caught in a trap. V'loyada ki b'nafsho hu, he doesn't know that his life is at stake. Meaning, they see food inside of a trap, but they don't know what's going to happen after they eat it. Right? The same exact thing is true. They're going so willingly to their own demise, to their own downfall, because they don't realize what the reality is. Fascinating, fascinating parak from Shlomo Melech here. Things that we've seen before in general, but in some ways also not necessarily common sense when we're in the moment, right? When we're in the moment, and as we said, it's pitom, it's very quick, and we justify it to ourselves. Well, it might be good because of this. It might be good because of that, and we think, oh, we can take care of any mistakes later. Rosh Hashanah time, whatever that is for that situation. Right, so all of these ideas, oftentimes, while they make sense to us when we're thinking about them here on a Monday night at 8:45 in a Mishle class, they make a lot of sense. But in the moment, we have to remember first and foremost not to do anything pit'om, not to do it suddenly, but to make sure we deliberate about what we're doing, to make sure that we don't have any biases, that we're not just justifying what we're doing because of some cognitive dissonance we want to get rid of, and we're not just jumping to a conclusion because we think that we're going to be okay because the husband's not home or we don't think there are going to be any repercussions. And we also make sure that we don't think that I can take care of any mistake that I'm going to be doing later on Rosh Hashanah or when I make up with somebody else. So those are all the types of things that maybe a person would think pitom right in the moment that we have to always be careful for and continuously check ourselves and ask ourselves and think about, instead of living very quickly and very spontaneously, but to pause, to deliberate about our activities, and hopefully through that we won't fall prey to these traps that have been set based on our desires. And Hashem wants us to fight against those desires. Those are the entire purpose of life, as the Gra told us a few prakim ago, in order to take Musar and break our habits. So, Mirtz Hashem, we'll continue next week, or we'll continue in 2 weeks with Mishle. Next week, I believe, is Legends and Lessons. We'll talk about someone's yard site. I don't know who it is going to be yet, but it might be the Baal Shem Tov. I think the Baal Shem Tov's yard site is at Shavuos time. So maybe we'll talk about the Baal Shem Tov. You'll have to come Monday night or read the bulletin to figure that one out. But thank you all for coming tonight. And thank you to the Atalis for sponsoring, for the honor of Irene's mother. Again, Shandel Bas Yisrael Halevi. Mirtz Hashem, our learning was Ma'ale her Neshama. Our learning was Le'ila Nishmasa, for the elevation of her soul. So again, thank you for all of you coming and signing on, and have a great night.